So tonight, I want to give a talk. It's on a favorite topic of mine. So it's not based on any particular sutta. It's just some thoughts on what I call the three modes of practice in the world, on the cushion, and on retreat. And first of all, when we think of practice, often what we think about is the middle one of those, right? On the cushion, a time when we're actually sitting formally in our daily practice. But in both the Satipatthana Sutta and the Metta Sutta, the Buddha says we should practice walking, standing, seated, or lying down, which sort of sounds to me like all the time. Right? It's like it has, and when are we not one of those things, walking, standing, seated, or lying down? And so the more I practice, the more I've seen that I can't in any way separate my formal practice from living in the world, my life, more and more I'm trying to just see my life as my practice that has these three aspects to it. Out in the world doing stuff, on the cushion in my regular week, daily sit, and on retreat. And finding some balance between those three. And I've come to this because I see how these three different modes support each other and feed off each other, are connected intimately. So the first one, in the world, I mean, the obvious question is, well, how can I possibly be mindful in the world? It's so busy and there's so much going on and I'm busy doing things and, how can you be mindful standing in the cashier line at Whole Foods or whatever, or at work? And there's a tough one to be mindful, right? But it's like we have to start thinking about this and try and find some simple ways to keep ourselves and remind ourselves. There's a real word, remind ourselves to keep being mindful all day long. But not it's not like we're going to be meditating all day long. It's not like we're going to, be walking around with our eyes closed, watching our breath all day long. But there are lots of things we can do. One of them is just to find cues in our daily life, things that we do repetitively that we use. We consciously set the intention to use these cues to remind ourselves to slow down and pay attention, maybe just for 5 breaths. Maybe it's, repeating the metta phrases for ourselves 3 times. Whatever, some little tidbit of conscious practice. And so, I mean, my favorite one of these, of course, is Thich Nhat Hanh's thing about what happens when you come to a red light. There you are on your bike or on your in a car or on the bus or whatever, and we come to a red light. And usually, when that happens, we go, "Oh, this red light is stopping me from getting where I'm going. It's an impediment. It's a problem." And what Thich Nhat Hanh said is, "No. Think of that red light as a reminder, oh, I've stopped anyway. I may as well just pay attention to my breath. I'm going to sit here anyway, and I'm probably going to sit relatively still. If I'm in a car, on a bike, I might be. Well, even on a bike, you're sort of stopped. You got 1 foot on the ground at least, probably. So you can just say, oh, every time I come, I have to stop on a red light. Let's consciously, mindfully pay attention. And notice not only our breath, but notice often the irritation that's there. When we're going someplace, which is when we come to red lights, when we're going to someplace, often our mind is already there. Like we're going someplace to do something, and so as we're going there, we're thinking, well, I got to go to, I got to make sure I go to those, get those three different things at McGuckin's, right? The hardware store. I'm going to go to this, and then I got to get this. Oh, and I got to walk up to that section there. And like we've got it all mapped out in our head before we even get there. We're not in the present moment at all. We're way off in the future. And so stopping irritates us because it stops us from executing our plan, right? So instead, we consciously decide stopping's good. I like stopping. I can use this time to just have a little moment of meditation, a few breaths, just a pause. Isn't this great? The light's red. It's just a shift of how we think. And it could be, it doesn't have to be a red light. I mean, some of you, maybe you work from home or you don't go out a lot, you don't drive the car a lot, so maybe you're not going through a lot of red lights or stop signs or whatever. So pick something else. I think one in our current culture, in our world, every time you turn on your cell phone would be a great time to stop and just take a few breaths before you start looking at what's there. Just let that be. Or, I mean, I know, maybe you spend a lot of time, walking around in your house. So every time you go from one room to the next, you stop and take a few breaths. It doesn't matter what you choose. It really doesn't matter what you choose as the cue. But if you set this intention to have these cues, then that means that all day long you're having moments of mindfulness, which tends to make you, in general, in your the rest of that day, because you're taking these little moments, it's more likely that if something really happens, you won't be so reactive to it, and you might actually be just be calm and, oh, that's okay. It's a bit crazy here, but it's okay. As opposed to being reactive to it. And this means that in the midst of a crisis, in the midst of difficult times that arise, we're in the world, and we live in the world, there's going to be times when difficult stuff happens, right? A problem at work, a personal illness, the illness of a friend, oh my God, look at this bill just came. I didn't know I was going to get this bill. I mean, all that stuff that happens because we're householders. It's much more likely that we're going to be able to just go, oh, yeah, this is unpleasant, but that's okay. Just that's what mindfulness, more continuous mindfulness allows us. It makes it more likely that that's what's going to happen. And we can just be okay with whatever's happening. I want to read a little bit from Kevin Griffin's book. And he's talking about actually practicing metta, but it's also an interesting thing. In the larger context of the Buddha teachings, we can put the idea of blending like milk and water under the category of sila, living virtue, the behavioral, moral, and ethical aspect of the spiritual development of the path of awakening. But the Buddha said that in order to meditate successfully, we need to live a life of integrity and non-harming, sila. How could we expect to develop inner peace if our outer lives were disrupted with squabbles, selfishness, and harm? Without the foundation of sila, no authentic spiritual growth is possible. So this is another aspect of practice in the world. It's like, can I, when I'm making decisions about what I'm going to do next in the world. It could be something trivial or some big thing where you're making some big change. You can go, oh, is this, where does this fit on in the world of virtue? Is this a virtuous thing to do? And consciously choose not to do it if it's not, doesn't fit your sense of virtue. Oh, yeah, that would be nice to do that, but no, I'm not going to do it. But that means that you have to stop and think about these things and think about it in this particular context. Not of, will this make me more money? Will this make me more popular? Will this make me anything? Is this, will this be more virtuous? That's a practice in and of itself. I mean, the thing about virtue is it's a practice in daily life. And it allows our mind to be still, more likely to be still when we actually formally sit, because we're not worried about something. Oh, is someone going to find out I did that thing? Or, oh, I shouldn't have said that now. If you're full of regret, all those things that happen when we're not virtuous. And then there's one other thing I want to talk about, and this is more common on retreat, but it's also, I think, things we can think about in daily life. Normally, we take what's called the five precepts, right? Non-harming, those things. But there's actually eight precepts for householders if you want to sort of take it to the next step beyond the traditional five. Instead of just non-harming, taking only what is offered, mindful speech, abstaining from sexual misconduct, and refraining from abuse of alcohol and drugs. Those are the classic five, which are all pointers to how we can lead a virtuous life by practicing those precepts. But the next three are also quite useful. To refrain from eating at the forbidden time. Remember, this is in the monastic tradition, and we'll talk about that both. And then to refrain from dancing, singing, music, going to see entertainments, wearing garlands, using perfumes, and beautifying the body with cosmetics. And to refrain from lying on a high or luxurious sleeping place. So these are, from a monastic point of view, big no-nos, right? When you don't, it's like, oh, there's easier, these are all forms of renunciation. On retreat, not eating at a forbidden time means not eating after the noon meal. That can be, if you take eight precepts on a longer retreat, which I've done. After the noon meal, you don't eat. You just, okay, that's it for today. And it's really interesting how, our mind is going, oh my God, I'm skipping supper. It's like, ugh. And then you realize how much energy you have because you're not spending all that time and eating all that food. You just don't need it. Especially when you're practicing intensely, you're getting so much energy from the practice that you don't need to consume extra amounts of food. But even if we don't do that, even we don't sort of in our daily lives, So in daily life, I think it means being careful not to eat too much, which takes energy away from our practice. I mean, you eat a, everyone's all, we overindulge, like we're at a restaurant and all the food's great and oh, let's get dessert too. And all of a sudden you're sitting there going, oh, well, they shouldn't have done that. You're just really full, extra full. You ate after you were full, but that dessert was really good. And just being very careful what we eat. And making sure we only eat really wholesome, nutritious food. This is the equivalent of that in the household or daily world life. And there's more and more stuff coming out about over-processed foods and all these sort of things that you see that are quite yummy, some of them, but it's like, maybe I should not do that. Maybe I should make sure I have to, probably going to take me a little more time, but then I can cook more of my own food from raw ingredients and basic ingredients, eat much more simply. And that literally gives you more energy to practice and be more aware in the world. And the second one, to refrain from dancing, singing, music, etc. Well, from a monastic point of view, that makes sense. What about us? I love singing and I certainly like dancing. But the whole thing about wearing garlands and using cosmetics and perfumes, and our culture is so obsessed with looking young. The amount of advertising around products that make you look younger or make you feel younger, it's crazy. I mean, no one's going to get younger. No one's getting younger from one day to the next. It's just not the way it works, right? It's almost going in the other direction. And I'm not saying you shouldn't sort of do what you can to look nice and, do that. But it's like, maybe we just have to not think so much about what our culture tells us we should do, and instead sort of just let our body be our bodies, take care of it, keep it clean, keep it healthy, and let that be enough. Let that just be enough. And part of this too is, our culture tells us we should never be bored. We should never slow down. We should always be doing something exciting. That's the singing and dancing part of this, that precept. And like I said, all those things are great. I love doing those things. But can we do them in some serious moderation, perhaps? And consciously choose where we do these things so that we don't go into places and environments that are where we get overstimulated. The last of these I love, because this is often a running joke at retreats sometimes. And that's like, to not have a high and luxurious bed. Well, if you've ever been on a retreat at a retreat center, there's no high and luxurious beds at retreat centers, let me tell you. But it's more, it's pointing to how we consciously try and get everything we can so we can be as comfortable as we can all the time. How being comfortable becomes something we can easily become something we become obsessed with. And the trouble with that is we need all this stuff to be comfortable, right? The perfect chair and the perfect this and the perfect that. It's all those things take up our time because we have to make money to buy those things. And now all the time we're making that money to buy those things to make ourselves more comfortable, we could be spending more fruitfully in practice or in doing something useful in the world, helping other people. And there's another aspect of this high luxurious bed from a householder's point of view, and it points more to don't be lazy. Don't laze about. At least not too much. Every once in a while, it's good to just crash. I'm in the point in my life where about, oh, once every couple of weeks, I go, oh, I think today's a nap day. I just have a 2 hour, an hour and a half nap in the afternoon. It's really, I feel so luxurious. But it's like, we have to look and see what we can do to sort of slow down those things. Lastly, the last thing is that carefully choose who we associate with in the world. And this might mean that there's old friends of ours, people we hung out with, or still. Then we go, every time I hang out with them, it gets kind of, I head towards the non-virtuous for whatever reason. Maybe I just need to say, gee, no thanks, I'm not going to do that with you guys this week or whatever. And this is like a conscious decision we make in our lives to tend towards not going to places where and getting involved in activities that are like that we know are like that because and they were when we were young and foolish, maybe they were great fun, but we just don't do them so much anymore. This is tricky, especially when it comes to family obligations. Once we have family and family, we always do the same stuff and we have fun in a certain way. This is what the family always does. And sometimes you have to go along because you don't want to sort of, separate yourself from the family. But sometimes you have to be able to go, man, not today. No thanks. I don't need to do that today. Let's do this instead. I mean, I'm not saying let's go meditate, but let's just sit quietly or let's go for a walk instead of going to the pool hall or whatever the family does, I used to hang out in the pool hall when I was younger, so that's the one I thought of. But it's just, once again, we have to think about these things. So the second mode of practice, as I said, was, on the cushion. You're having a daily time when you sit. And the most important thing is that you actually do this, that you actually have a daily time you sit, that you consciously choose to have a daily practice. And it's so easy to let that slide. In some way, which it becomes, oh well, I'll sit when I feel like it, or I'll sit when I'm in a good mood, or some such idea. Practice, daily practice is a discipline. Our culture thinks discipline is bad. You're supposed to just have fun, right? But discipline is how we learn to do things when we don't feel like them that we know that are wholesome and useful. Whether it's sitting or doing your daily exercise routine or whatever. I'm a big track and field fan. I've been watching little videos on YouTube of stuff going on, the World Track and Field Championships are going on right now. Man, these people lead really disciplined lives. To do what they're doing, it requires incredible discipline, practice, 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 really careful with their diet and all those sorts of things. It's amazing to watch them because it's like I admire their discipline. I was never, I played sports, I played football, and I played basketball, but I was never like a big star or anything like that. But I appreciate people who are, who because it shows how disciplined they are. The secret, I think, to having a daily practice that really helps, and I've said this many times, but to have a regular time and to try and sit in the same place. Have a spot where you sit. And a time when you sit. And the time doesn't have to be exact. It could be, I'm going to get up, I'm going to have my coffee, and then I'm going to sit. And so sometimes you get up at 5:30 and sometimes you get up at 6. It's not a big deal. Like him, your death, but that's the routine. Because the mind then gets into the rhythm of that, and it's like, oh, it's time. It's that time. when I'm going to sit. Oh, I'm sitting in this place, in this chair, in this little corner with this little statue of the Buddha. Must be time to go still. The mind reacts to cues like that. That's why the regular time, regular place is so useful. And it also is really important that you don't get discouraged and beat yourself up if you miss a day. We're householders. We live in the world. Stuff happens, you know, and crazy stuff happens where all of a sudden we think, you know, oh, I have to, you know, take a shuttle to the airport to go visit my mother, and the shuttle picks me up at 5 in the morning. My normal sitting time is 6. I guess I'm not going to sit today. That's okay. I mean, I tried once to actually meditate on a shuttle going to the airport. It was pretty disastrous. But it was like I was determined, you know. But it's like we find something like that. Daily practice is really strongly emphasized in every spiritual tradition I've ever come across. Whether it's a meditative tradition or things like in yoga, in various yoga traditions that I've practiced in at times. And it's so important, partly because, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, it makes how we work skillfully with what arises in our daily life. No matter what is going on, I'm going to do this. I formed that intention. And makes you practice both when you feel like it and when you don't, when you're not in the mood. And we sometimes think, well, why should I go sit when I know my mind is a train wreck already, and I go sit, it's just the whole sit's going to be a train wreck. But you kept the discipline. That's what's important. Keeping the discipline is more important than having, quote, a good sit. You sat. You were there. You did it. That's what's important. That's what builds that continuity of practice. And with this, we have to understand that some days are going to be smooth and wonderful, and some days are going to be unpleasant and chaotic. That's just the nature of sitting practice. We're not exempt from that. And then there's the third mode of practice, which is on retreat. In all Buddhist traditions, in fact, all contemplative traditions, have retreat as part of their system of practice. And retreat essentially means stopping doing all your regular activities and removing all the things that distract you from your day-to-day, moment-to-moment life. And so, you know, in the tradition I'm familiar with and practice and teach, this includes noble silence. So we stop talking. When you're on retreat, you consciously turn off the verbal part of your brain somewhat. You can't turn it off completely, but you know, meditation and what we're trying to do in training the mind uses a different part of the brain than the part of the brain that has to do with words. So stopping talking, stopping reading, stopping writing, which are all parts of traditional Theravada retreats, means you're toning down that part of the brain. You're still going to be talking to yourself. I mean, we all will talk to ourselves. So there's still going to be words, but some of those words are like simpler than reading and writing, which really stimulate a particular part of the brain that is different from the part of the brain we're trying to actually make go still. So, the other thing about retreat It's the idea of all every retreat I've ever been on, and it's always been really emphasized, is that we track practice all the time. Like we wake up, we start practicing, and we practice till we fall asleep. I've heard people say you can practice while you're sleeping. I wouldn't even bother to try. But basically, literally, from when you wake up to when you fall asleep, Joseph Goldstein tells this great story about some teacher he was sitting with a lot back in his days when he was a monastic. And he'd go to meet with the teacher every other day for a practice meeting. And one of the first things the teacher would often say is, "When you woke up, were you inhaling or exhaling? How mindful are you of your daily, of what's going on moment to moment?" Once again, I'm not suggesting that extreme is necessary, but it's a pointer to the idea of, we on retreat, you have times when you sit, there are times when you're walking, there's times when you do things to take help to keep the community together, there's times when you just go for a walk in the woods, but all of those times can be practice time. And it's that continuity of practice, the long continuous practice that allows you to go deeper. This is the reason we go on retreat, is it, the mind just slows down and goes in deeper into the practice. It's really clear to me that that's true from my own experience. It sounds like, oh my God, you want me to not talk, not read, not write, and just sit and walk and practice all the time. You got to be kidding. I mean, the first time someone told me this, I was like, really? It was difficult. But the thing about retreat is you're practicing with a group of other people if you're on a retreat where people are a group of people are practicing together. And that support of the other people who are also, on those moments when you're going, oh my God, you got to be kidding, he wants us to sit again. Then you see everybody else going to the hall and sitting, and you go, oh, yeah, they all seem to be able to do this, so I guess I can do it too, and off you go and you sit. And it's during these times where we go deeper into the practice, where the mind goes stiller and more focused and more concentrated, and mindfulness is more continuous, or loving kindness is being cultivated more strongly, that the insights of what we call this, some people call what we're doing insight meditation, right? Insights arise more frequently and more powerfully on retreat. It's just that's this is where that sort of mental, emotional activity arises. And we start to see really clearly what underlies all the activity of the mind and body, which is just things arising and being there and then going away. We start to not understand impermanence as an intellectual idea, but we start to experience it as a reality. And with that experience, we then start to go, how can, if everything is changing all the time, how can anything out here in this world be satisfactory in the sense of making me happy all the time? Because it's going to change. And then, so we start to see the three truths more clearly, experientially. Now, here's the problem. I talk about retreat like, well, everybody can do this, but it's not true. There are lots of people who can't just sort of drop their lives and go someplace for a week, either for health reasons, physical reasons, they have responsibilities in the world they can't leave, lots of good reasons. But Think of the following idea. You get up in the morning, you have your coffee, your breakfast, what you do your normal early sit first thing in the morning. Maybe this is the evening instead of the morning. I mean, it depends when you're normally sitting. And then you go out for a walk in your neighborhood, conscious, silent walk. You've turned off all your devices. Haven't turned on your computer yet. Your phone's turned off. So the things that normally distract us aren't there. We go for a walk in nature, and nature might be just, in your neighborhood in the burbs. There's lots of nature in the suburbs. And then you come back, you eat a simple, nutritious breakfast. Maybe you prepared it the day before, so there's not much effort. And then you go and sit again. And then after you sit again, you get up and you do some formal walking practice. Might be outside on your patio, or it might be up and down the hall of your apartment. Just someplace, where you can do formal walking practice. And then you go sit again. You've just been on retreat. This is exactly what happens on retreat, and you've just taken, 3 hours of your life as opposed to my regular half hour. I've decided today I'm going to take 3 hours and do a 3 hour practice session with these components in it. That's a retreat. Doesn't have, don't have to go anywhere. Don't have to pay any, no, it doesn't cost you anything extra. It's just you've constantly chosen to set aside this time. And it might mean you have to sort of, let people know, oh, I'm not going to be available Thursday morning until after lunch. Whatever. Because that's what you're doing. You're going to do your practice. Maybe you have a buddy and you can do it together. Or a partner or whatever. Get together with someone else and do it together. It's always easier to do these things with somebody else. It's the power of Sangha, right? So that's the third mode, the retreat mode. And it sort of powers up the other two, I think. I always think of like a retreat is in some sense like charging up my batteries, where I that more focused long term day moment to moment to moment all day long practice literally charges me. So that when I go back into my daily life and daily practice, I have more energy for it. My batteries are full. That's why I keep having to go on retreat to recharge my batteries. So there's these three modes of practice, right? In the world, in our daily practice, and on retreat. And these three really complement each other and support each other. And I think hopefully I've made that obvious. And basically, you start to see your life as your practice. There's not my practice and my life, or there's not my practice and the rest of my life. There's just my life, which is a life of practice. It's a way, it's a change in how you look at things. Of course, have. A couple of pieces of poetry here. This is from Hafiz. It's called I Got Kin. It's very Hafiz-like. Plant, so you own. So your own heart will grow. Love, so God will think, ah, I got kin in that body. I should start inviting that soul over for coffee and rolls. Sing, because this is a food our starving world needs. Laugh, because that is the purest sound. So he's just pointing to the simple little things that open our hearts and minds. Pay attention to those more than other things, perhaps. And the other thing that I think is important, and why I think practice in this sense is so important, it's the only way I can think of to change the world. I mean, the world's pretty messed up right now. The only way I can do anything that can possibly change the world is to practice and then let the energy of my practice radiate out into the world. And maybe that's just me, but I think it's a pretty good reason to practice, to see that my practice, I know that my practice affects others. It's very clear to me. I see it all the time. So it seems like the most useful thing to do. This is from Dana Falls. Called the fruits of practice. Despite fervent pleas for ease and safety, there are many days when reality doesn't quite line up with what I choose. Breakdown, letting go, surrendering even the illusion of control, breathing into the unknown. Sometimes that is what life holds. Practice hasn't brought an end to pain. I'd still increase my own suffering like a fish caught on a line. My struggles only draw the hook in deeper. But being in reality is its own reward. It's the perfect paradox. The courage to stand and breathe when everything in me wants to flee is as great a gift as the freedom to seek retreat. No, practice hasn't brought an end to pain. But it has honed my willingness to experience the moment and sometimes see perfection unfolding in ways I wasn't big enough to plan, much less predict. Practice isn't about achieving a goal. It's not a means to pole vault over suffering. Practice is my way of looking life in the face and saying yes to all its disparate gifts. Practice keeps me awake when I would sleep and reminds me it's the journey. Unfolding in this very moment, it's the journey that reveals the truth and not the destination. Very true. So that's really all I have to say.